Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm very excited. My brother from another mother, Martin Ware, is in the house.
Ooh.
Oh, my. I am very excited about this. I've not seen mine for a little while.
We are big buddies.
We are. And he's a legend. And I don't use that word. I say that, you know, jokingly, but Martin is a legend. And we are good buddies. And I've not seen
him. I'll agree with that. I'll take that.
He concurs with being called a legend. Martin is. I'm going to embarrass you now, Martin, by listing some of your accomplishments. But you are, I believe, one of the UK's true innovators.
Thank you.
No, seriously. And what's interesting about Martin as an innovative person, he's an interdisciplinary innovator.
That's deliberate.
Yeah, and I think I want to get into that a bit in the podcast. But music, sound design, art, theatre, design itself, education, .. and branding, which we're going to touch on, entrepreneurship. He was founder of one of the first electronic music bands in the UK called The Human League. And has spent 40 years at the helm of the British Electric Foundation, his production umbrella, one of which was the band Heaven 17, still touring.
I like the hand action. I'm very happy with that.
I'm waving my hands at him here. Yeah, buy your tickets for Heaven 17 in the UK and across Europe in 2022. He's had over 50 million of sales worldwide, producing people like Tina Turner, Terence Trent D'Arby, Erasure. So, you know, not too shabby. And as a 20 years at the helm of the illustrious company, the company he founded with Vince Clark from Erasure in 2000 to develop their unique three-dimensional sound technology. And it's really mind-blowing, that stuff. So please check it out if you ever get a chance to. He lectures extensively across the world. He hosts a podcast, Electronically Yours, with Martin Ware, and has got guests like Nile Rodgers, who's a hero of mine, Boy George, and Moby, and many more. But do you know what the biggest highlight of his career was? I'm going to call you on this. Apart from DJing at my wedding, which I believe was the pinnacle moment of your illustrious musical career, he was also co-founder of the world's first sonic branding agency, a company called Sonic ID, with I'm just going to check my notes here. With me. It was me. Yeah. Who set it up with me?
You when you had hair. Yeah.
Well, we both had hair. Then. We both had fine locks, actually. Martin and I both morphed into each other. We've sort of shaven our hair off. Of course, I'm not going to offend Noel Franis, who's our partner in crime over in America. We'll get onto that in a little while. So Martin and I have had to I've been sort of blessed to be able to be part of Martin's illustrious, interdisciplinary, innovative career. But before we get into it, I'm just going to remind everybody the podcast is brought to you by my company, The Tech Department, the one I blew up and saved again. I'm talking to people like Martin to help you not mess up your bloody business like what I did. So if you like that kind of spirit, share it with your mates. Tell everybody about it. Help me help other people. Get on it. Right, Martin, I'm going to kick off. I'm going to take you back in time to the parallel podcast I've just set up for today called Honey, I Blew Up the Band.
Nice.
Do you like that? And Martin had a band called The Human League, which he founded back in the late 70s in Sheffield. But he was famously kicked out of it, turning himself into a rock cliche or a kind of Spinal Tap moment, perhaps.
Well, more like what they call him from School of Rock.
Yeah, exactly. So if you ever watched the film School of Rock, Martin was there first. He was kicked out of his band.
I think he was probably based on me.
I think in many ways reminiscent of you, educator extraordinaire. I was always curious about this because everyone, we talk about this moment in your life and in music history. But the day after that happened, what were you feeling? What was that feel like?
A massive sense of betrayal. Phil was my oldest friend from school. We met when he joined King Edwards in Sheffield in the fourth form. We immediately became best friends and, you know, basically we used to hang out together all the time. I mean, we were bosom buddies for 4 years. And then when it came to, we were looking for a lead singer for the Human League, when we started the Human League, we're not really from the musicians' world at all. We're kind of like outsiders. Didn't really know any musicians because we were not traditional musicians anyway. And I said, well, I've got this friend of mine, Phil, who's he's really good looking. He's got an interesting haircut, which is kind of one-sided. And I have absolutely no idea whether he can sing or not. So, and Ian Marsh said, yeah, okay, let's get him in and try and, you know, we'll do some kind of backing track, and then we'll ask him to put, you know, to write some lyrics over it and sing it and go away and do it and come back, do it on cassette. And so he came in, listened to the track, liked it, which is the backing track of Being Boiled, took it away, came back a week later and said, all right, here it is. And he started up it and went, listen to the voice of Buddha saying, stop your sericulture, and going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hold on a sec. What's sericulture? So it's the boiling of silkworms for their silk. And it basically was a metaphorical tale, as he admitted later, confusing lots of different religions together, conflating, and a metaphorical tale about, I think he had a bit of an issue with his dad, because his dad was, I think he was the chief postmaster of Sheffield, but he was like devoted to his world. I never met him, even though I went round to his house all the time. I still don't know where he looks like. I never met him. And I think Phil really, a lot of the songs on the first couple of Human League albums, quite a significant number of them, seem to be about a resentment about abandonment, I think.
Really?
Interesting, yeah. Hmm. Things like Corona Baby, which is a massively weird Human League song, is like a kind of Grimm's fairy tale about a dysfunctional relationship between a father and a son, I think.
Hmm.
Wow. Anyway, so it's a bit deep to start off with. I know it's not exactly...
We've gone way deep, yeah.
Not exactly fucking X Factor, but there you go.
Don't worry, we'll be telling inane jokes soon. So you've got this relationship with Phil, and then...
Yeah, the day after you asked. I ignored the question.
Yeah.
The day after, I felt complete betrayal. He came completely out of the blue. He was like a brother, you know, so... devastated is the only word. But then it had all been pre-planned fait accompli-wise by our manager at the time, Bob Last, and the record company. So Bob had already prepared for me being upset, and he said, oh, come up to Edinburgh, which is where he was based, and we'll talk about ideas for what you can do, you know. So I went up to Edinburgh with my wife at the time, still very upset. That's a couple of days later. And it was Bob that came up with the idea of a production company, BEF. I mean, I'm cutting a lot of stuff short here.
Sure.
But BEF, he said, what about being a production company where you can have multiple identities and sign up as a production company to Virgin? And I thought this was a really exciting idea. And I said, I've got it. It just came to me in a light bulb moment. I want it to feel like it's an entity that's always existed, and you've kind of dropped in. You've not noticed it in the past, but now you noticed it. It's a bit like, you know, I don't know, some kind of insouciant, eternal banking entity that you never noticed, but just happens to be the third biggest company in the world or something.
Mm.
So I said, all right, it needs to sound proprietorial. So why don't we call it British Electric Company? And he said, no, can't do that. Sounds like an electricity supply thing. He's on the phone to the lawyer going, can't do that. No, it's misrepresentation. But the lawyer said, you can use something instead of company, you can use something that is vaguer, that maybe has a kind of educational or charitable implication. So they came up with a list of things, and one of them was British Electric Institution, and I thought, it didn't quite sound right there. But then when it said foundation, that was the perfect positioning. I thought, it sounds like it's been there forever. Foundation could be either educational, or it could be a kind of fund that funds things, or it could be a massive financial institution. It could be an educational, you know, it could be anything. So we said, right, BEF sounds good as well. I didn't realize it was the same initials as the British Expeditionary Force that we got trashed in Dunkirk. But anyway, at the time. So BEF, we settled on it. I said, and I've got a great idea. I need to have a logo that looks like it's been around from the 30s or something. So it needs to be, if you imagine it kind of embossed or engraved into a brass plaque outside a big Palladian building, you know, that kind of thing. And anyway, Bob and his wife, Hillary, went away. They're both graphic designers and came back with the BEF logo, which was that kind of Roman bold thing with a tape reel. So it's brilliant. So it was like, it looked like it could have been around forever. It was time travel, you know.
Yeah, it still has that got a timeless sort of quality about it. So how long was this period between you being booted out of the Human League to you sort of forming this sort of entity that had been around forever? What was that? How long was that?
4 days.
4 days?
Yeah.
Really?
I was on fire with righteous indignation. And it became clear once the split had happened that there was a kind of arms race on between what I was doing and what the original Human League was doing. And the race was to get product out to the public as soon as possible and take the high ground. And didn't need any further motivation. I've never been so motivated in my life. So this is a lesson for your listeners. You can either get down about stuff, and of course it's natural to be upset when major events like this happen, but if you can convert that energy into positive, affirmative action, that's the answer.
So
not everybody can. I'm not saying I'm not brilliant. I just happen to have that in my locker. But it's something that should be aspired to.
Well, it's a fuel cell.
Yeah.
How are you?
Absolutely. So we were working in the same studio in the next few weeks. We'd already asked Glenn if he was going to be our lead singer, and we formed Ember 17, which is the first BEF project. And we started work. This was 2 weeks after the split. He came up to Sheffield. I asked him in the pub next to the City Hall, around the back, can't remember the name of it. He immediately said yes. Within a week, we'd written Fascist Groove Thang and recorded it.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's all happening at a kind of lightning speed.
Yeah.
So this kind of fuel cell really jettisoned you off.
Oh, absolutely. And continued to for years. It was like, you know, nuclear fission.
Yeah, it's really interesting, that kind of sort of powering up through, well, I know John Lydon said anger is an energy.
Oh, it is, yeah.
So looking back at that time, because that's such an iconic moment, and it was so packed, dense, full of like activity and energy and all these emotions. Like that 4-day little window, it's almost like looking back at it, can you see now the sort of threads or the kind of particles that then the Big Bang exploded and then over the last 40 odd years has sort of expanded out? Like, can you see that now?
Yeah. It's a singularity.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, I've had to reevaluate all this in detail because I've just more or less finished my autobiography, which is coming out next year. So I had to go through it in forensic detail, but not just literally the things that happened, but to actually recreate in my own mind, because I'm sure Phil has an entirely different version of it to me. But I know what I saw and I know what I felt at the time, so that's what I've laid out. So I understand all that. I understand everything that you're talking about now in forensic detail.
So what is it? What's the learnings in there? What can you see that panned out?
There was another element, which was a massive motivational element, which was Phil gave an interview in the national press, in the music press, about the split, and he wasn't very complimentary about us. But then behind, you know, because Bob Last, who was our manager at the time, was managing the Human League and us simultaneously, so we got some back channel kind of information. And Bob said to us, Phil said that he didn't want to ally with the anesthetic part of the group anymore. I know. Right. So I'm going, A, that's not true. But B, how fucking rude. And it was kind of implied in the article that was in the paper as well. Mm. So I'm going, right, not only are we going to beat you, literally, in terms of creativity, and we're going to beat you in terms of style as well.
Hmm.
So fuck you.
Wow.
And that was, so yeah, that those two things were the big motivation. Not only that, so Phil and the band were in Sheffield. We were based in Notting Hill, very close to where Virgin Records was. So we didn't have management. Well, Bob was helping us a little bit. He was based in Edinburgh. So we had to go into the record company. We didn't have to, but we wanted to go into the record company and try and work our charismatic magic on the various departments, which you could do in those days because it was all in one quite small building in just off Portobello Road. And we made it our mission to become friends with all the heads of department, particularly there's a woman called Gemma Caulfield, who was Simon Draper's kind of majordomo. But also, she was the glue that stuck the whole company together. Everything, you know, she had a desk by the door, literally. Everybody who came into the building, she knew was there and where everyone was. You know, like the Groucho Club used to be fantastic because all the staff used to know where everybody was in the club and they could say, yes, and so-and-so's here. And that's all gone now. But anyway, it's that kind of vibe. And so we targeted Gemma particularly, Simon Draper, head of A&R, head of press, which is Keith Burton, who became our manager later, head of production, and that pretty much covered what we needed at that point.
Mm.
So it was a strategic. Bear in mind, we're only like 23.
Mm.
So I mean, looking back on it now, I think that was a smart move. It was clever.
Yeah, it's interesting because you see, almost what happened is you had this sort of, well, these various elements that were prodding your buttons or pushing your buttons from the split. And then you attack the problem.
Yeah.
But in a way that's quite, I mean, again, it's funny how we're going to, it's a podcast about entrepreneurship, but really what you've done is gone out and strategically planned to influence a network of people to persuade them to prioritize you, I assume, in the arms race.
Exactly. No. We weren't saying, oh, you know, pay attention to us, not the Human League. It was because two elements to it. One, we didn't have anybody representing us. We couldn't trust Bob, obviously. Oh, I still like Bob, but you couldn't trust him. nobody's going to look after you if you don't look after yourself. But the key thing in organisations, when you're working directly with them and they are in charge of your fate, essentially, is you've got to be in their face all the time. So we'd invite them out to the pub, you know, every Friday evening they'd have, all the staff would go and have a drink in the Earl of Lonsdale on Westbourne Grove. You know, Richard Branson would be there, Simon Draper would be there, all the staff would be there. And it's just like human contact. It's such an important thing.
Mm.
You know, that's why I have a big problem with the current, I know it's COVID and everything, but this current, oh, we don't need to go back into work thing. Well, you know, in boring jobs, obviously, probably you don't. But in creative agencies, you do, in my opinion, because you're not getting the admixture of different ideas randomly. You're sucking randomness out of the system.
Yeah, so I think that point about randomness is a quite an important point, actually. But just on that, so how did you see... So just, I want to come back to that, but like, so you're now in the pub on a Friday night, make sort of networking.
Yeah.
Network. You perhaps didn't want to call it that or didn't see it as that, but you were sort of almost like kind of on the offensive out there.
We wanted to be the most popular band that was signed to Virgin. That was our ambition with the staff.
Right.
Because they loved us. They loved us. And we got so much more money out of them, so much more effort out of them. You know, we suddenly get to the top of the pile for pluggers. You know, all those little things that add together to make a success.
What did you
think? It's not for the public, but you know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, what do you, so from that, again, looking back at it, what did you think you learned from that? Going this sort of period of like this explosion of activity and sharpening up your thinking and all that kind of energy, the nuclear fission.
We'd have never, well, I can only speak for myself, but I suspect it was the same for Ian. If we'd have had a traditional manager, if the splits hadn't happened, things would have just continued in a similar fashion. And maybe it had gone well, maybe it would have grown very slowly, maybe it would have declined slowly, maybe, I mean, the thing, the catalyst was the fact they weren't earning enough money back, basically. So they wanted to hive off Phil as a simple pop star. Whereas we could be similarly monetized, but in the more creative end of things, right? So, but we didn't, you know, we didn't want to play that game. We wanted to play the game. We wanted to play them at their game. So that's what we learned was self, self-motivation, self-belief, that maybe underneath that you couldn't really trust, you know, trust had been broken with both management, obviously my best friend Phil from school. We'd never had a serious argument in our lives before this happened. You know, trust had been broken. So really, I think looking back on it now, it's like, you've just got to do it yourself. And so this over-reliance on a kind of infrastructure being built around you for success, it is not to be relied on. You know, it's a pack of, it's a house of cards, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, particularly for an artist to be in this sort of stark, call it kind of the clothes being ripped off the emperor, you know. And it's like, well, okay, we're kind of, I've got to like make this work for myself here, this kind of self-sufficiency thing. And in fact, knowing you, knowing how you operate, that kind of, you are a very independent spirit. And you have this kind of self-starting aspect, I guess, the entrepreneurial aspect.
Yeah.
It's interesting. That's the sort of, do you see that in yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm completely self-motivated. I mean, I'm in a, I've always been in a nice position where I've usually had a like a recording studio in my own home. So you've got to be self-starting. You don't have any option. What are you going to do? You're going to sit there like fucking Sting in some manor house and go, I've got a studio here and, you know, I'd rather go and do tantric sex with with doodah. Or go and, you know, go and ride around on fucking go-karts in my manor, in my gardens. Or, you know, I'm not... Your creativity, I think, is a vocation. And I think, I mean, it's got a great benefit in as much as, you know, there are obviously financial rewards to it if you do it well. But less nowadays, by the way. But, you know, nobody's forcing you to be creative. Nobody's forcing you to go to work, air quotes. If I don't, I mean, I've got a lovely studio here now, but I had a studio at home because I wanted to be there for when my kids were growing up. I always have the means of being creative musically. I don't have to ask anybody to do it. I don't have to book a studio. I don't have to ask anybody's permission. I think doing something creative every day has been the best decision I ever made. When I reached 50 and I did a kind of stock take of my life, it's the best self-referential motivation. It's like having a fucking Apple Watch alert going, you know, do something creative. It's 11 o'clock. And I've just got that ticking away in my head all the time. So I think consistency is important. Motivation. And a kind of acknowledging yourself a kind of vocational aspect. I feel like music and creativity in general is my vocation, and I feel compelled to do it. I don't do it for money. If money comes from it, that's brilliant. And, you know, I'm lucky enough that I'm not desperately short, but that's not what motivates me. I've turned down some incredibly, on the face of it, incredibly lucrative projects all throughout my career.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't feel it was the right thing to do at the time. Not just from a moral point of view. Sometimes it just didn't fit with how I wanted to develop as a person or my creative thing, or, you know, all sorts of motivations.
Mm.
But there is a moral aspect to it as well.
Yeah, and I think that's what's interesting is this sort of, well, there's a few things nested in that. There's a sort of discipline to actually do it, if that is your vocation.
That's a very Sheffield thing, isn't it? That?
Yeah, we're just going to get
work ethic.
Yeah, well, very much so, yeah. And also, it's like, but it's actually, before that, recognising that the creative vocation is your vocation.
Yeah.
Right, point one.
It didn't come back. It didn't come to me in terms of reflection until much later in life, by the way.
Well, it's interesting that, because you would assume you'd have been conscious of that all the way through.
No, I just thought you kind of assume in a kind of deep down subconscious manner that it's all going to evaporate one day, because you feel like you're busking it a bit, you know.
Mm.
I don't think I'm busking it anymore, but I made more money when I was busking it. It's quite interesting.
It's funny. So on that, you mentioned about self-belief earlier, and one of the things I've always liked about you, Martin, was your kind of like ability to, well, at least on the outside, observing you, sort of create something and put it out there and be like, fuck you.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And you sort of own it. And that's something I know I've struggled with, where you kind of start noodling with something because you're a bit worried about how someone will react to it. Could you speak on that, like in terms of like your self-confidence or self-belief around your creative or output, your creative product?
Well, I know a few people who are similar to me. I'm not unique by any stretch of the imagination.
Sure.
My modus operandi is shoot first and ask questions later, in a nutshell. So work on the basis of your intuition, you know, modulated by your experience.
Mm.
So the more, there's another a kind of paradigm that feeds into this, which is the more, what I've learned from experiences, the more that I try and chase the money as opposed to the thing that makes the money, i.e. the creativity, the more the money runs away from me. So if somebody came to me and said, I want you to do something, look, I'll pay you well, but it's a bit boring for 3 months. I just wouldn't do it. I don't care. Mm. Even if it would allow me to just go and have a fucking holiday in Barbados for 9 months, I'm not interested, because that 3 months is as valuable to me. I'm never on holiday. I'm never at work. You see what I'm saying? It's like, I enjoy what I'm doing now, talking to you. I enjoy making music. I enjoy doing the podcast. I enjoy helping and mentoring students. I enjoy educating. That's the payment. There, right there. Mm. In the admixture, you're going to get paid for some of it, and some of it you won't get paid for. But that's neither here nor there to me. So I don't have a particularly affluent lifestyle. I'm not bothered. I don't require a lot. I've got a very low bar for happiness. Given the vicissitudes of life, I think health of your family and happiness in your personal relationships pretty much sums it up. But creativity, yeah. If somebody said to me, I was incarcerated for whatever reason and I wasn't allowed to be creative, it would kill me. I'd be dead in a month.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. So you've got this compulsion, this part of you.
It's a vacation, yeah.
Yeah, and so this kind of big bang happens and this explosion of creativity happens in a way that's kind of actually quite motivated, disciplined, strategic. So there's a kind of interesting paradox there, because you're not floating around being creative. This is a very focused and intentional creativity, with a purpose behind it and an edge to it. And just want to sort of zoom ahead, actually, just sort of to 2000, when you set up the Illustrious Company. Because it almost, I know the early BES stuff and the Heaven 17 sort of album art, if you've not seen it, you have a look, but like Penthouses and Pavements, where you're kind of almost dressed like a yuppie and a businessman. Yeah, okay. So this very almost parody of entrepreneurship and business, and 20 years later you set up a company and we start being entrepreneurial, and I'm just curious, like, How was sort of the nexus of setting up the illustrious company, and do you sort of this sort of entrepreneurial period?
The irony of the cover of Penthouse and Pavement was based on an advert for Toshiba, I think it was, in Newsweek, which Ian brought into the studio one day because he was always reading things like National Geographic and Newsweek. It was like completely different to us, and he showed us this painting, which was like a montage, very similar to the front cover of Penthouse and Pavement. And we said to each other, literally, we haven't got a fucking clue about business. We don't even know about the record business. But wouldn't it be funny if we gave the impression that we did? And it was all part of the BEF thing, right? So it's all knitted together, like the company that's opening doors all over the world. I mean, all these meaningless phrases, which you know all about because you're from the world of marketing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's just an endless number of them. Some of them were generated like William Burroughs, like through the cut-up method. We just chucked a load of cliches into a hat and picked out different parts of a sentence and stuck them together. And, you know, like tomorrow's music today and, you know, that kind of stuff. And that was Human League, actually. But so there's always been this kind of coming from a poor working class steel, you know, toolmakers family in Sheffield. I didn't know any business people at all. None. Not one. Mm. In my extended family or anything, none of my siblings or previous ancestors had been to university. We were completely separated from this kind of mysterious world of the bosses. Mm. And so because obviously we're socialists and we wanted to parody that relationship, and hence the luxury gap as well was a reference to that. Which I still think that cover is fucking awesome because a lot of people still don't realize that the, you know, it's appealing poster on a you know, if you open it out, it's a peeling poster. You can see the peeling off at the top. So the illusion is this luxury.
Right. And
the reality is the scrapyard behind.
Hmm.
So, yeah. What was the question again?
No, I mean, it was just talking about how business and entrepreneurship and how you a parody and then you become a kind of,
yes,
almost become a version of your parody of yourself.
That's exactly it. So, but because we didn't have our own management and because of this thing we were doing with Virgin, suddenly we had this kind of organic insight into the world of entrepreneurship. We, by default, had become entrepreneurs.
Mm.
And we saw the internal mechanisms of how a business was structured in a record business. We used to talk to Simon about it. We used to talk to the guys in the stock room. We used to talk to the people who were doing the press and the publicity. We used to talk. But, you know, the most important things we learnt, personal relationships, but also things like supply chains.
Hmm.
You know, actually getting those records to the shops. You could have the greatest song on earth and it could be on every playlist on Top of the Pops, but if you don't have the records in the shops at the right time, it's not going to go up the charts. And that happened a couple of times with us.
Really?
With Let Me Go, for instance, on the first single off the second album. They just had fucked up the supply chain.
Really?
So that meant, even though we were on a Radio 1 playlist, if it doesn't come in at a, if it doesn't come in the top 40, you can't get on Top of the Pops. Mm. And there was some supply issue to do with various shops because there'd been some controversy about, this is a bit technical, but it's important to understand it. At that time, they had a panel of record shops that the BPI used to take the figures from. So it was a sample of maybe 10% of the shops of sales in Britain, and they take a sample, and that's how they make the chart. But the record companies had a kind of inside information which shops were being targeted. So But then the public found out about it. It was some expose. So they had to back off for a while. So then they had to go back to distributing all the records equally amongst the shops. Just at this moment in time. Anyway, it had an effect on us. And it had an effect on various other people as well. So it's not like today where everything goes into a big computer and the figures come out the other end. It's not like that at all. It was all quite... There's a bit of bungarella and payola going on. Stuff like that. So we learnt about all the dark arts as well.
Right.
So it wasn't a deliberate study course. It wasn't like, you know, going to a business school or something. It's like everything else we've done in our career. We're autodidacts, right? We have an enormous hunger for knowledge and work. In a nutshell. Yeah, so if you want to, you know, most artists have got no interest whatsoever in the business side of things. All they do is go, oh, bloody record company ripping us off, you know, bloody hell, look at all this. And I didn't realise that was needed to be recouped. And well, take an interest in your fucking business then.
Mm.
You own the intellectual property rights to this stuff you're creating. Well, certainly the publishing side of it anyway. And you better understand the value of the recordings that you're making because they own it. They're going to own it in perpetuity. Our records from that period and now all our catalogue is owned by Universal, who I loathe. You know, it's like the Antichrist. It's passed down to the devil, right? So you better understand early doors what you possess and how much it's worth.
Mm. That's interesting. I think that applies to... It's funny, any kind of... So the act of entrepreneurship or building a business is itself creative, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, the mechanics within it, now there's different disciplines and different skills, but the act in itself is creative. And what you just said there is like the act, recognizing the value in what you're creating. Because I've been guilty of this, where you're just giving away the gold for free because you're so happy someone's paying attention to you because your creative thing, your business is just sort of in its early stages or going through a difficult time or what have you. So again, so looking back at all of that and looking back at where you are now, what do you think, what have you learned? What's the sort of takeaway skill that someone listening today can apply to their business today?
Takeaway skill, right. Well, I would say understand thoroughly every element of your business and the context it's operating in is what... this was never a stated ambition at the outset for us. We just learnt it through sheer, enthusiasm, I suppose. We didn't know what we were looking for. We didn't know what we didn't know, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you'll know this, you know, if you start a small business, particularly in the creative field, nowadays, it's much more rationally organized and they all go, you've got to have a five-year plan and here's projections for years and Q3 is going to be a bit difficult and all that bollocks. I never had a business plan in my life. Not saying that's a good thing because I've always believed that if you do things for the right reason, then funding and money and if you understand the nuts and bolts of how to deliver things on time, on budget, you build in the correct margins to what you're delivering, then the ball keeps rolling and the pot keeps growing.
Mm.
I mean, that's the essence of it, isn't it? Yeah. It's a bit like the classic Dickens thing of, I can't remember the exact quote, it's like, you know, income £1, expenditure £1 and a shilling, with all misery, you know. And and it really is that simple.
Mm.
But if you don't understand the nuts and bolts of A, what you're delivering, and B, how you're delivering it, and C, I suppose, who you're delivering it to.
Yeah, sure.
They're the three components. You've got to understand that shit. You've got to understand your audience.
Mm.
And I don't mean focus groups. I mean, you've got to understand who your audience is. That's who you're going to sell shit to.
That's a really great shout. I think particularly for creatives, and business. I think what you just laid out there is just like a real masterclass in keeping it simple. But to this point about your audience, understanding your audience, what you have is that a lot of entrepreneurs don't have is you have a literal audience in that respect, and you're stood on a stage in front of them. And I know that Heaven 17 has a very strong relationship with its audience. What do you think? Have you learned something from that kind of like literal performance and literal engagement with fans?
Oh, absolutely.
That you could apply to a business context.
Good Lord. I think it's, I mean, brand loyalty is everything, isn't it?
Mm.
So we decided when we formed BEF and Heaven 17 that we weren't going to perform live anymore because we'd lost a lot of money. A lot of money, which we would have to recoup eventually. Because you had to pay to get on tours in those days. So we're on tour with Susie and the Banshees, Bear Ubu and Iggy Pop in Europe. We were probably $250,000 in the hole. Not that it was not money out of our money, but we would have to pay it back eventually. Mm. And in fact, we only recouped with Heaven 17 in 95, believe it or not. So what did I learn from that about brand loyalty? So when we started performing live around about 1996, I think it was, and we started getting offered 80s days, you know, where there was multiple bills. It was just a kind of testing the waters then for the promoters. They didn't really know what it was worth, and it proved to be incredibly popular. Then we started doing our own headline tours. We supported Erasure on a big arena tour. We did da, 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 da. And so built it. We even done things like Butlins.
Hmm.
And Pontins, which we will never do again, I have to say. And then you start getting offered gigs abroad. And, you know, before COVID, we were due to do our first coast-to-coast full headline tour in America.
Wow.
Which might still happen. And so it's taken 20 years to get up to this point. But the key thing for us, we're fucking great. We're okay, you know. We are a good act.
Hang on.
We deliver.
You are a great act. No, seriously, I've seen you many times live, and you are a great act. So,
we're a good distraction for a couple of hours. It's nothing more significant than that. But we get a lot of repeat business, right? A lot. There's one particular. We call them diehards, the guys who followed us right from the start of us performing live. There's one guy called Sumo from Liverpool who's coming up to his 250th gig.
Really?
Yes. But there's probably about a dozen who've done over 100.
Really?
Yeah. And then so on and so forth. It's like a curve, you know, logarithmic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there's lots of repeat business. We're just a bit of a relief from existential terror, I suppose.
Is that what you put on your LinkedIn biography?
A relief from existential terror. It's on the posters.
That, I think that is going to be your new LinkedIn.
2 hours relief from existential terror.
Featuring Martin Ware.
Asterisk. Only if you buy the merch.
Yeah. Conditions apply.
Does not always work. But doing that, and the other thing is multiple career strands.
Mm.
So as I explain it to the students, it's like I teach work into commercial brief. So I often talk about Sonic ID. In fact, I show, case studies that the presentations we used to do and
really,
stuff.
Really, yeah, great.
As for Sonic Branding, one of them, and then obviously Illustrious. But then we have this, you remember that big chart that was, and this is for the listeners, obviously it didn't make much sense, but we did a presentation we used to show to clients why they should consider Sonic Branding, integrated Sonic Branding for their brand.
Mm.
And it was like, well, I can't remember the kind of chart it is. It's the one with a circle in the middle and lots of little circles coming off
it. Yeah.
And it was all the touch points of how sound connects with the customer. And, you know, things like, you know, everything from old incidents on the internet, in shops, on the radio, TV, film, blah, blah, blah. So I do a similar thing, and I liken it to keeping plates spinning, right? So I always say to them, they come into this, the MA course of songwriting production, going with stars in their eyes, you know, going, I'm going to be a star. And some of them might be. Mm. But more likely, they're going to end up working, doing a portfolio career, you know, where they have to do multiple things associated with the same thing. And that multiplies your opportunities in terms of employment. And also, they are more employable by people who want to employ them, because they want recruiters increasingly want people with multiple skills.
Mm.
So there's that element as well. It's really interesting, I think. So I have acquired, since Illustrious started, a whole bunch of skills that I had no intention of acquiring. None. I have no interest in being a company director. I've got no interest in plan. It sounds stupid when I say it, but planning ahead. I'm not that bothered about money and growing big money pots. I'm interested in keeping the ball rolling in a positive direction.
Mm.
And that is enough for me. So if you want somebody who's going to be a Jeff Bezos, I'm not your man.
Mm-hmm. But you're in the game. You're playing the game, and the game is the creative game. And that's what you, as you've said, is your vocation.
Yeah.
So you're getting the pass to play the game.
Yes, exactly. And that's no joke, by the way. Mm. I mean, having a career in this field for 40 years, there aren't many.
No, that's very true. And I think to have that longevity is a real achievement.
It needs adaptability, mm. and it needs resilience, and it needs resilience is such a bland word. It needs bounce back ability, you know, yeah. Like Alan Partridge.
You are, yes, the Alan Partridge of pop. bounce back ability. we're
coming back.
Aha! 2 hours relief from existential terror and all your money back.
Hello, Dan. Guess who's back?
Right, we're nearly at the end of our podcast. That's flown. I believe I could spend all day talking to you, Martin. Right, you're so amazing, and thank you so much for sharing so much. I like to ask this question at the end, just in 60 seconds. What advice should entrepreneurs ignore?
Try not to be too formal in your approach. There's a whole swathe of business school-led orthodoxy, which is everything. There's a formula for success.
Mm.
And it's all about metricizing and all that. I don't think that's the case. I think you've got to follow your gut instinct. And the people who are genuinely derive great benefit from doing what they do and normally are very successful are the ones who follow their gut instinct.
Mm. Good advice. And follow your gut instinct. And yeah, I'm learning to tune into that more for myself.
Well, if you don't follow your gut instinct, what are you? You're just some kind of person who's rinsing money through a machine. It sounds like I'm talking like listen to him, he's a creator. You know, it's not that. I just mean, even if you're the world's biggest arsehole, but you want to sell fucking spigots to Korea, are you interested in what you're doing? Because if you're not, what's the purpose of your life? Is it just to make money?
Well, I think that's actually a great point to sort of focus on for the entire interview. What's the purpose of this? And if you're not getting any joy in your heart from what you're doing, why are you doing it? You know, and I think what's been great, that applies to anybody. Like, if you love it, selling spigots to Korea, selling your heart and your gut. And I think they're having, for me, actually, there's something that in that of aligning those things. So your head and your heart and your gut. And so it's all in one space.
Absolutely.
And if you can happen to make money from that, then you've really hit the jackpot, because that's just the fabric of the substance of doing that day in, day out is what's going to make you happy.
Exactly. Content. Exactly. I mean, the number of people I see Yeah, I've just been in Spain with my daughter and in Estepona, which is on the Costa del Sol. And there's loads of kind of retired English people out there, you know, and obviously a lot of them have had a fairly tough life. Maybe they've been builders or plumbers, or they've had a small business or whatever. They look totally, you know, wasted, most of them. They look like they... Yeah, okay, I've been told this is the fucking Shangri-La. This is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And they're going, all they do is like wander about like zombies in town all day, having a cup of coffee. And it's like, no, everything's the same. It's all the same. You can derive pleasure from anything until the day you die. It's not to do with the world of work. You've been brainwashed.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great shout. And I think this is it. It's like getting, so the retirement Shangri-La is a fantasy. And really, it's the it's kind of having that experiential bit every day where you're doing something you love. I mean, that's the key.
Exactly. I'm 65. I've got no intention of retiring. Fortunately, my health is good. You never know how long that's going to last, so you better make the most of it. You know.
Yeah, that's great. Where should people find you online, Martin? Where's the best place to look you up?
I often say I'm the world's most contactable person. So they can find me online on Twitter, Martin Ware. I do have a blue tick, but don't blame me for it. I'm on Facebook as Martin Ware. I don't have any pseudonyms. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. My email is martin@illustrious.co.uk. You can contact me directly. You can contact me via the Electronically Yours with Martin Ware podcast. That's it. I mean, if you can't find me, you're not Sherlock Holmes. Let's put it that way.
Oh, that's the quote of the day. If you can't find me, you're not Sherlock Holmes. That, in fact, it's going to be. This is my merch. That line is going to go on a T-shirt. Oh, fantastic. Well, yeah, check him out. Get tickets to go and see Heaven 17. Listen to the podcast. It really is fantastic. Thanks so much for being such a legend, as always. It's lovely to see you. Really.
Yeah, you too, mate. Love to the family.
I will do. And, thanks, everybody, for listening. And send my love to your family, too. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And I'll see everybody next time. Big love. Mwah.
Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box. Just enter it in, and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it, and the more we can help. So help us. Help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company... give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.